Hey, just a heads up that the following content may be disturbing or triggering for some listeners and is not appropriate for children. Please take care of yourself and others who may be listening with you. Welcome to the Bonus Babies Podcast, a show that has no easy answers, only hard questions.
This doesn't sound relevant, but it is when you hear what happened next, which is my mother and my stepfather, they got a van. And Ford Aerostar van at a police auction, which was apparently a cartel for Mexico that transported drugs, cocaine. And the technology wasn't there back then as it is now, but I guess the police missed deep in the panels of the van bricks and bricks of cocaine. I don't know how many kilos, but there was a lot. And so you would think that my parents would call the police, say, hey, we just found this, you know, we don't want it. Well, that they did not do that. They held on to it, and that's where everything changed.
Can you tell me what you call the kids who you've cared for over the years?
We feel that the children that we receive coming into our home are bonuses, so we call them bonus babies.
I love that.
This is your host, Jane Amelia Larson, and I'm a CASA, a court-appointed special advocate volunteer for youth in foster care. Yeah, I know, it's a mouthful. In the same way a CASA works, I explore all things in the foster care maze by talking to kids, parents, caregivers, attorneys, social workers, therapists, really anybody and everybody who will speak to me to keep the conversation open and the information flowing about all things CASA.
Hi, this is Jake Everly, the producer of the Bonus Babies podcast. And today, Jane Amelia speaks with Georgette Todd. Georgette was born to a 16-year-old runaway mother. But shortly after she was born, her mother reconciled with her parents. And so for the first 9 years of Georgette's life, she lived in San Diego with a stable family, with her uncles and her grandfather around and rose bushes out front. But then her mother met another man who took her out of that bucolic scene and brought her into something completely different. But we'll let her tell that story. Here's Georgette Todd.
Hey there, I'm here with Georgette Todd. Hi, Georgette. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hey, I know that this is a big time for you right now because it's the 10th anniversary of your book, Foster Girl, and you are coming out with a new edition, right? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so it's going to be out on October 1st. And, you know, it's a big deal because a lot has happened in the last 10 years. And I think my readers they've reached out over the years on my website saying, what are you up to now? What are you doing? And just getting the feedback from my book, it's been just mind-blowing. I didn't know if anyone would buy it. I didn't know if anybody would care. But I hear from people all the time. They trickle in, and it's just been incredible. So, yeah. But I thought, you know what? It needs an update.
Yeah, it's a great feeling, isn't it? When you put out your heart and your mind and your psyche on the page, and then people respond, right? Wow.
It's incredible. And then what I love too is like they open up about their stories with families or their how they've been touched by foster care or hearing directly from survivors as well who are older and even young people who get access to my book too. That's been wild and crazy in that, you know, I didn't know if they would even get access because I know kids in foster care, there's all these gatekeepers around them. And so the fact that some of them found a way to get access to my book. And when I hear from them directly, how they relate so much to my book and they just have all these questions like, how did you make it? How did you write a book? And it's just really great to hear that kind of feedback.
Well, it's a wonderful book and it's a very moving story. I know you know that. But so I want to ask you now, not in book form, but tell me a little bit about your own upbringing, your family of origin. You're from California, I know. And tell me a little bit more.
Okay, so I was born to, my mother was a teenage runaway. And, you know, in the 70s, they didn't really have any resources like they do now. And she got tired of her life at age 14 and said, I'm done. She didn't like where she was growing up. And so she ran off to Portland, Oregon. And 2 years later, at age 16, she had me. Now, because she was a teenage runaway, she did not want to be found. And so she didn't even put her real name on my birth certificate. So to this day, my mother's real name is not on my birth certificate.
Wow, really? Wow.
And yeah. And so, so that then she reunited with her family, she made amends, and now that she had a daughter, me, she went back home and they reconnected. And so then I basically, the first 9 years of my life, I lived in San Diego, California. And in that time, this is what I tell people to this day who say, like, how did you overcome so much? First of all, I didn't overcome. It's still with me, and I'll go into more of that later. But I really do think, Jane, what's made a fundamental difference in my story compared to a lot of foster youth stories is that I had that structure and stability the first 9 years of my life. That was critical. I never had to worry about which home I was going to live in, who I was going to live with, what my identity was. I was living in this middle-class house with rose bushes and in this great community. And I had a lot of family members. We had aunts and uncles and cousins all through the house. And my grandfather lived with us and my mother. My dad was not in my life. But I didn't feel alone because I had my grandfather and my uncles who were just these giants over 6 feet tall. But where things took a turn is when my mother remarried a man who I call in the book called Mad Dog. And
Mad Dog.
He had a misspelled tattoo.
Yeah, and nothing good can happen from somebody who's named Mad Dog, right?
And he was, correct. And so he was, you know, at this point, I'm 9 years old. My mother's like, in her early or mid-20s, and he was in his early 40s. And so he was butting heads against my grandfather and, you know, her brothers, my uncles. And so he just had enough and decided to take us away. And what predators do is they isolate from the family. And that's what he did. And so from the next few years, we bounced around. This is before foster care. We bounced around in a different state and different cities every year. And I lived in homeless shelters. So I had that exposure while living with him and my mother and my sister. I'm not going to talk too much about my sister because she's very private. So I'm just going to just tell my story. So then we then ended up settling into Salt and Sea Beach, where everything changed. So Salt and Sea Beach, for people don't know, it's actually about 45 miles south of Palm Springs, I think 158 miles east of Los Angeles, and about maybe 70 miles north of Mexico. I should nail this down because it's really important. But so it's this Salt and Sea is California's largest lake. It's also the most polluted lake. And it's like this fringe community out there. And it's just this ecological wasteland. Back then in the early 90s, it's not as bad as it is now, but it was, you know, a lot of trailer parks. And you got to understand, I grew up in sunny San Diego in this nice big house. And now I'm living in this little trailer in a trailer park by a polluted lake that they call a sea. You know, it's such a cultural shock. And so dealing with that, and then I made friends everywhere, but in this community, I was very isolated and had a really hard time making friends. And so at this point, I'm in my, we got there when I was like age 11. But then when I turned 13, I started developing. I started puberty and I was already tall for my age and well-spoken and I read a lot. But I just seemed to develop overnight. And that's when life got very crazy. Male teachers were treating me differently. Girls were making fun of me even more so. Boys were propositioning me. I mean, I was this bookworm in this body, and I just wanted to just lose as much weight as possible. I wanted to be invisible again. And my mother was very thin. 5'11", like 120 something pounds already, or 130 something. And my sister's really thin. And so I wanted to be like the women who were around me. And so this doesn't sound relevant, but it is when you hear what happened next, which is my mother and my stepfather, they got a van, a Ford Aerostar van at a police auction, which was apparently a cartel for Mexico that transported drugs, cocaine. And the technology wasn't there back then as it is now, but I guess the police missed deep in the panels of the van bricks and bricks of cocaine. I don't know how many kilos, but there was a lot. And so you would think that my parents would call the police, say, hey, we just found this, you know, we don't want it. Well, that they did not do that. They held on to it. And that's where everything changed. Drug use in that community at that time, it was not uncommon for kids and people to use drugs. And I mean, the nearest police station is probably like 20, 25 miles away. It's right in the middle of nowhere. And so anyway, my parents started using, and then I shortly started using after them because I wanted to lose weight. And my stepfather said, hey, if you want to lose weight, just drink some water. We'll put a little Coke in there. It's like Coca-Cola. They did it in the 1800s, you know, before they outlawed it. And it's like an appetite suppressant. And I'm 13 years old. I'm like, well, he's like, just try it once. If you don't like it, don't try it again. Well.
Right. So this is like a super dangerous diet mm-hmm. that he concocted for you, in which you were going to lose weight and become invisible.
Yes, which is what I really wanted.
By using cocaine.
Right. And at that point, I tried every diet. I slim fast, low carbs, cabbage soup. I spent lots of hours walking in the desert just trying to lose this weight that I suddenly gained once I started puberty. And so I tried it, got hooked, and immediately what I found by taking cocaine, especially at that age, I didn't care how I looked. I didn't care about anything. I just cared about, it made me happy, which I wasn't. And, you know, I became more all about the drug. Everything else just melted away. And so then that made me susceptible for abuse, which is what happened. And after I experienced some abuse with my stepfather, but I kept taking drugs, more drugs to self-medicate that experience. And then I OD'd in Palm Springs. And I'm right now trying to get the hospital medical records of that time period, because I talk about all this in Foster Girl, a memoir, but I want more documentation about that time, you know.
Right. You know, what's really interesting about your book and your stories, though, is that even in the version you have now, you have quite a bit of documentation. You have a lot of your court records. You've got pictures. You've got notes from teachers. It's remarkable because a lot of kids who've been through the system have nothing. You know, they can't find anything related to them. Either their records are closed or they're lost or they burned down or they only had a chance to look at them briefly. But it's very interesting that you tell the story and then we see the caseworker's notes on your experience. And it's so incongruous and also so fascinating. It's really a nice way to tell the story from many different angles.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah, I actually discovered that technique when I was at Mills College for grad school. I knew I wanted to write a book. I just didn't know. And I knew I wanted to write about my life experiences, but I just didn't know what shape it was going to take. And I got exposed to so many different types of writing styles. And when I talked to my professor, who was an author from India herself, she was like, she's like, if you have a case file in foster care, I said, yeah. She goes, it's, you know, and I said, I want to access that for my thesis. And so that's what I did. So yeah, I didn't have access to my case file until I was a grad student. And I went to San Diego. At this point, I was living in the Bay Area. So I went to San Diego and I requested a copy of my case file. And Jane, I was this really poor college student. I mean, the brakes weren't even working in my car unless I pumped it. It's so dangerous. But So I was really tight with money, and they were going to, the county clerk or the juvenile court clerk said, I'm going to charge you 50 cents per page. There was 300 pages.
I know, it's crazy.
Yeah, $150. And then I talked to a friend of mine who works in nonprofit, and she's like, why don't you just write a letter to the judge? And so I did, at requesting a copy of my case file and to waive the fee. And thankfully she did that. And that's how I was able to get my case file. So yeah, wow, but I really wanted to show, not there is, okay, there are two things why I put those files in there the way I did. And I, there's obviously a lot, but not too much. I mean, you still get the narrative. It just kind of supports the story. It shows the reader how the system tracks their care of me. It also gives their perspective, but then you hear my perspective, which is not in my case file. There's all these different strangers writing my story.
Right.
And I'm not in it unless it's like a quote here and there. And so I was like, I'm going to write my story from my perspective. And thank you for the paper trail, state of California.
Yes, right. The expensive paper trail that luckily you don't have to pay for, because I've heard that too. Now I think it's a dollar a page, believe it or not. And
oh my God.
And as if you're in the system from a, you know, if you start when you're 2 or 3 years old, your case file can be hundreds and hundreds of pages long. So at that time, then, now everything goes upside down. You're doing drugs with your parents. You're compromised by your stepfather and by your mother. And then he gets arrested and he gets put away, right?
Yeah. When I overdosed, he got arrested right then and there. You know, I was revived. And at that point, so he goes to jail. And then my mother shortly died after.
That's right.
So she died about 6 months after. And the cause of death is unknown. She was only 30. She had some cocaine in her system, but not enough to finish her off. And so, yeah. So then, so when my mother passed away, my grandfather, her father, came out and took care of me. And he's this like Navy veteran, never had a record, just an upstanding citizen. And he's, you know, he has his own house in Alabama. He's set. He's like a really great role model. And he came out and he saw these drugs. He's like, whoa, 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 I'll smoke a little grass here and there. But this stuff, this, we need to get this out of here. He don't want anything to do with it. And so my stepfather said, hey, I know somebody who can take it off your hands. And also you'll get a little money on top of that. Give the girls a nice Christmas. It's the first one without their mother. And so my grandfather should have just like been by the book and said, no, I'm calling the cops right now and take it off. But he didn't do that. He listened to my stepfather. He's like, fine, whatever, get it out of the house. I remember that time where my grandfather was like, I just want this out of here. Because I knew about it. I don't think my sister knew about it. But I definitely knew about it. And so how the quote unquote transfer, I don't know anything about that. I just knew where the drugs were and that we had them, but that's it. And at that point I stopped doing drugs because my mother died. This has destroyed my family and me. And I felt so much shame. And so I just stopped doing that. And even to this day, I don't even do anything. I don't even smoke. Nothing.
You're a bookworm, as you said. You like to read. You like school.
Complete opposite. Yeah, exactly. So then the drug deal went down or whatever. Like it was the friend that my stepfather told him was a friend of, you know, that will take the drugs off his hands was my grandfather's hands was actually an undercover DEA agent. I didn't know any of this. You know, I didn't even know the specifics. In fact, my grandfather said, you know what? You know, once he saw the drugs, or once I like told him where I was at, he's just like, I'm just going to get rid of it. He's like, you're a kid. Like, let the adults take care of this. Like, you worry about your mom, you worry about your school. He was being a parent, you know, and I grew up with him. And so I had that connection with him. And so I'm like, okay, just get it out of here, whatever. And then the undercover DEA agent, obviously there was a raid and the cops put guns to my head. And this is all before foster care, but that was my entry into foster care.
Right. So you lost your grandfather because he got put away. Right. And then, and he was who you and your sister were going to go live with That was your life moving forward, right?
Right. And so they actually, I guess they bugged our phone. And so they found that my grandfather's story checked out, the one that I just told you, that he just came out to take care of his granddaughters. He had nothing, he doesn't want anything to do with this, just get it out. He's not using it. He's not dealing with it. He just wanted out of the house. But so since the story checked out, they let him, they released him early. I think it was like a week. But by that time, my sister and I were in foster care. He's like, all right, let me get my grandkids. And we're just going to go back to Alabama. And this will be just a really bad experience. We'll put it behind us, start a new life. And if the court said yes, I would have been in foster care, or I would have been in it for just that week. And we have relatives, a lot of them in Alabama where he lives. But the courts are like, nope, you know, now you have a record. And so that's how my sister and I entered the foster care system.
And then hell really hit the fan. It was bad up until then, and then it got just worse and worse and worse for you.
Yeah, I got to say, though, that the abuse in that time, I'd say 1993, I'm still more impacted to that day. I feel like it's like the principle and then the interest is foster care just compounded the trauma. And it definitely brought up like new issues to think about, or, you know, it brought up more. Yes, it was hell too, but that I got to say that year at 1993 was the worst year of my life. And I'm still touched by it to this day.
You know, so what you portray so well in the book is, and I don't think people think about this a lot, especially people who don't know anything about the system, you really portray very well the institutionalized nature of foster care, the punitive nature of foster care, and how you know, you've got your hands behind your back. There's all these locked doors. There's locked refrigerators. You're only allowed outside for a certain period of time, if at all. And this happens over and over again with you. Very rarely are you in a warm, loving home. In fact, not till the very end with Judith, right? Mm-hmm. She was the first person who saw you as a child and not a problem, who opened her house in a transparent and loving way.
Yes, and we're still close to this day. She's now in her 80s, and she likes to keep telling me, I'm in my mid-80s. I don't understand this. Like, you can't use that for an excuse for everything. But so we are close, but it took me a while to even be emotionally close to her. You know, it took me actually for a long time. I didn't even say the words I love you to her. I don't call her mom. You know, you talk about Bonus Babies podcast. She's a bonus mom, you know? So she.
Yeah, she's a bonus mom.
She's a bonus mom. Yeah. Yes, definitely. What separated her from everyone else, because I bounced around different foster homes, is she didn't have these great expectations. And I think it really helped that she was a high school teacher. So she was around teenagers all the time. She wasn't scared of teenagers. She thought teenagers were goofballs, you know, and that are just trying to figure themselves out. But she also came across kids who were in foster care throughout her time as a high school teacher. And she just felt sorry for them. And she just felt for them. And I was 16 when I went into her home. And that meant I had, the clock was ticking. I had less than 2 years to be prepared for adulthood. And so I just really looked at her house as this. To be honest, I didn't say, oh, I finally found this really great parent, because by the time after all the stuff that I went through and all the mistrust I had for adults, I just had a strategy, Jane. I'm like, okay, I've been kicked out of homes just for having one argument, not a fight, an argument. And I'm like, I'm going to reduce conflict. So I'm just going to sleep as much as I can. I'm going to, you know, do my homework. I'm going to work after school. Like, I just avoided Judith a lot. When you live with someone, little things come up. I would find myself biting my tongue or walking away because in foster care, you have to be performative. You're in someone else's space, you know, and she could kick me out at any time. I did relax a little bit after being there a year, but I still had that in the back of my head. I hope she doesn't get into a car accident. I hope nothing bad happens to her. I hope she doesn't change her mind, because if she did, I would have to start all over again in a new environment, new school. But yeah, she was really great in that her approach to teenagers. And also what also helped too is that, you know, she, one of the first things she said to me and my sister was, you know, I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. Here are my ground rules. Here are my expectations. So she was very clear up front. This is my home, but I want it to be your home. And I kind of, for me, I didn't feel that until she started putting pictures of me around the house. That's when I kind of felt like, okay, this is
like, I belong here. You mean like you felt like you belong there because you saw yourself.
Yeah. I saw myself in her home. I saw myself on her refrigerator. She had this thing where she would take photos because she was also a photographer, and she would then laminate it and put it on her refrigerator. So that was fun. I had a different relationship than my sister did. My sister was more like wanted that mother role. At that point, I felt like I just need to get myself ready for adulthood. I just need to just buckle down, save as much money as I can in my after school job, and just get my education on track, go to college, and just start a new life. That was where my mindset was. And it worked. And she even said, you know, we talked recently about this when I visited her in Indiana. She said, you know, the fact that you were so well behaved is what I could, she's like, I couldn't handle it if you were, had all these behaviors. And I really appreciated her honesty, because that's actually, sadly enough, I know, like, I'm going to defend Judith here with that, because, you know, a lot of kids, they have all these traumas and these behaviors and whatnot. Yes, they do. But I just, at that point, I thought, I can't mess up. I can't make mistakes. And she said that she was sorry that I felt that way, but she understood it. But she said, I couldn't handle all these extreme behaviors. You know, she just said for her life, and she didn't even have kids, so she didn't even have that kind of background. But it's interesting that she said that about me, but my sister tested her greatly after I left the house, and she didn't give up on her. I don't know why. Like, she stuck it out with her, but, you know. But yeah, with me, I think it's because I was older, and I think it's because I had that, like, arm's length. I just felt like I couldn't relax, you know. And it right. wasn't because of Judith. It was just because of all the things that predated Judith. You know.
Of course, it sounds super stressful if you always have to be so careful about what you say, what you do, you move the wrong way, you do the wrong thing, and then you're out on the street again
yep.
and have to start all over.
Which has happened, yeah.
Let me ask you, you write very frankly in the book about very early on in your adolescence, you started to feel suicidal. You had thoughts of harming yourself, and you fought those then that for the next many years, right?
Yes. Yeah. And when, I'd say my last real suicide attempt, yeah, I had it definitely in the first time. It was definitely in foster care, and there was a scene. I know what you're talking about, where it happened. I was in a residential facility. And it was Christmas day, and I had no family calling or visiting, no Christmas card, nothing. And then there was donations, which I gotta say, if you're listening, if you're gonna donate this Christmas, please donate something for teenagers. There's a lot of teenagers that they get overlooked. And I remember there was all these toys, which is nice for the kids, but there was like nothing for teenagers. Not that that would have solved everything, but it just kind of like you had nothing, you know. I had nothing, and I just got tired of life at age 15. I'm like, I'm done. I had enough. I'm ready to check out. I don't know where I'm going in the ether, but I'm tired of this dimension, this plane. I'm over it. Goodbye. And so I, you know, tried to commit suicide, and then I was put into a facility for 3 days. It was, you know, on suicide watch. And that's when I got exposed to, I hate to use the word crazy, but somebody who had really mental health issues, real bad mental health, like the person, you know, was punching himself in the face. And I'm like, oh, okay, I wouldn't do that. I think I kind of woke up. And even though I was really sad and depressed, I just continued.
Right.
It was just a call for help. And I was just tired of it. And I think the fact that the holidays, you know, had something to do with it. And it was like around a little past the 1 year anniversary of my mother's death and all this stuff happening. So it was a reaction to my life and a way for me to get control. It's like, I'm done with this. But I did get some therapy, get some help. And now I'm completely not suicidal. I'm the complete opposite. I have so much to do and so much to say on this earth. Like, no, I can't leave yet. I have so much more writing to do and more talks to give and more. I'd love to start giving back in terms of talking as an elder to foster youth, foster teens, and the Tay population especially. And I just gave a talk the other day, and it was so incredible to pass on the wisdom that I wish I knew when I was their age, you know? So I still have a lot to do.
Yeah, you know, I think that work is particularly important because what I've seen with kids, especially kids who are teenagers in care, they don't see a way out. They're exhausted by the system failing them, by people failing them, by their family failing them. And they don't see a way out. But then they hear from somebody like you who has been through it and who got through it. And it gives them, I think, a little bit of hope, something to hang on to. Like, I can dig deep inside me and figure out what I have in order to get to the other side. That's what I think. And I bet that's true. I bet they see themselves in you, right?
Yes, that's the feedback I've gotten even the other day. And not only hearing from them, but also hearing the person who facilitated, they talked to her and they were telling her that they felt seen, they felt heard. It was good to hear from somebody that they could relate to, but also see make it to the other side. They don't see enough of that. And I agree, because when I was their age, I didn't see someone like me. We did have speakers here and there, and they were well-intended, and they were all polished and great. And you can tell that they cared, but a part of me checked out, because I'm like, yeah, you had two parents, okay, just, I don't want to hear it. I tuned them out, because I'm like, you don't know what it's like to be me. You may be nice, but I'm checked out. and that's how I felt. And so I don't have to deal with that when I speak to the younger population. Like, once they hear my story, they're like, okay, she gets it. She's been there. But what I like to do is just share, like, what I know about life now. Here's what I want to tell you. Here's what I would do if I were you. You know, here's how I would prepare myself. Here's how I would deal with depression at your age. Here's what to watch out for. Here's how to prepare yourself. Here's what an IRA is. I don't even know, like, how to financially set yourself up. You know, like, I didn't learn a lot of this stuff until I was in my 30s, you know? So I want to tell them everything about life that I know now, kind of like as a parent does with their kid. So I don't have children, but this is like the best. I feel like that's my way of parenting, is giving back. And so I want to do a lot more of that.
And there are some wonderful resource links, guides in your book that people can go to who are interested in supporting foster youth, either by becoming a CASA or becoming a foster parent or just giving their time. So when you get the book, please, people out there, please do get the book. It's very moving, very informative. And then also there's this great section at the back which talks about how to support kids in the system. I want to ask you, Georgette, how did you arrive at a place where you were able to find some stability in a relationship? I know that as you've written in the book, and this is some time ago, that relationship has been tested, but you got through it. Are you still in that same romance, and are you still getting through it?
Yes. So we've been together. He's my partner. We've been together for 18 years. And he even said one time, he's like, I think it took you 7 years to like start trusting me.
Wow.
And yeah, and he's right. He is right. Cause I always felt like anytime we had an argument, I'm like, okay, this is it. Even if it's something small, I had that anytime there was a conflict. Cause you know, that came from foster care. That didn't come from the abuse before. I feel more secure in the relationship, but there's always going to be that part of me that it's just there. It's just like, well, be prepared. you know, if it doesn't work out. But I feel like with him, how did I get to that place? You know, just one day at a time, and also seeing that he, you know, has been there for me in ways no one else has. And he's seen the good, the bad, the ugly. And I did emotionally, I was emotionally abusive and I didn't realize it. And until I got therapy and help. And now we were very processy. This is how I feel. This is what I'm hearing. The tone they use.
Yes.
But it works. And, you know, we've had couples therapy. And so we're in a really great place right now. And yeah, we're just, I just, he's really been my rock. And I'm really lucky to have had him in my life. He's definitely the opposite of what I grew up with. So that's something I sought out too when I was someone, I had this thing about, I don't want to become where I came from. And I just would like seek out people who were just, I know what toxicity looks like. I could see it a mile away. And I'm like, yep, detour. Nope, I'm not going down that road. Not dealing with that. It's a lot. It takes a lot of psychic energy to be stable, even to this day. It just takes a lot. That's why I'm alone a lot, to like think and write and therapy. And, you know, I just don't want drama in my life. And thankfully, my guy is the same way. He doesn't want drama. So.
I want to ask you about something else that you wrote. I know that you know that your mom loved you very much and you loved your mom. In fact, I think in many ways you idealized her. She was very beautiful. She was, people were drawn to her. She was like a firefly, right? But you also acknowledge that she failed you and she ended up dying, and so that she didn't have to face really what was going on. But you seem to forgive her for that too. Do you, or did you have to process that?
That's a really great question. So, you know, I idealized her when I was young. I then got angry at her. I got very angry. Like, how could you have let this happen? And also too, I have a niece now who's the age that I was when I was abused. And I looked at her and I'm like, I would never harm her. That just like the last thing I would do is harm her in any. So writing has always been my go-to in processing. And that's, I mean, yes, talk therapy helps, but nothing gets deep down into the bowels, if you will. It really gets to the core like writing does for me. And we had this one writing workshop when I was at Mills College, my grad school. We had to write about our parents outside of the relationship to us. Who are these as people? Who are they before you were even born? Who are they, you know? And we had to do a little research and figure it out. And so what I've come to, I actually had a lot of compassion towards my dad through that exercise. You know, I found out he was in foster care. So I'm like, oh, I'm not excusing it, but it explains a lot of behavior with my mother and just processing. And then later on talking to my uncle, who's still alive. He's like, you know, your mom was not the same when she got shot, after she got shot. And I only knew her when she got shot in the head and survived. I was 4 years old. So I don't have that comparison like before and after. So there is this, you know, my mother had a lot of damage to her brain, you know, so there's that. And then also she was very loving. It's just when a man came into our lives, it seemed to just upend everything. But outside of that, she was really loving. And then drugs came in and then she changed. I saw a shift there. And so I wouldn't say I forgave her. I understand her more. And I still have some anger towards her because of that, but I also think, you know, I still love her, and yeah, I'm still processing.
I want to ask you something else that I ask all my guests, and that is, what is one thing that no one would ever know about you unless you told them? Now, it's a little tricky because you've written a book with some very private matters, but is there something like that about you that no one would ever know?
I would say there are two things. One good, one like I'm not proud to say, but I think it's important to hear this audience to hear, especially if you were in foster care. The first one is fun. I'm a great dancer.
Wow.
I'm a phenomenal dancer. I don't know where that comes from. Horrible singer, but I am a phenomenal dancer. And people are like, oh my God, where are you getting your moves from? Like, I don't know.
That's great.
Yeah. And I think part of that too is because it's genetic. My father was a musician, and that was something when I was learning the violin. I don't play it now, but like I picked it up really quick, you know? So I have that rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there's that. That's a fun, interesting fact. Another one is that I got to be honest, like right now, I'm getting older and even though I'm like decades away from retirement, it's something heavy on my mind. And I'm just looking at how I manage finances. Even though my partner, he's really great financially, he's fine. I have this emotional block, you know, I don't want to hear things from him, you know, and my best friend who's like really into finance, this investment banker, I don't even want to hear it from her. I want to hear from somebody who doesn't have an emotional connection with me. I know that's so weird, but you know, I want that separation and I just want numbers and facts and how do I set myself up financially and take care of myself that way. And then I want to impart what I learned to the younger generation. So I should have figured it out by now. I have in some ways, but others I'm like clueless and I shouldn't be, and I am. And so
right.
I'm embarrassed to admit that, but.
Right. So how do you feel that's related to your time in foster care, that you didn't have the foundation or the security to feel I can figure this out?
Because when you're in foster care, you're reliant on donations and on the government taking care of you, people other taking care of you. And I just didn't see that role modeling on how to handle finances. Right. I didn't see it at all. Money management. I didn't see that at all. And I'm a good saver, but talk to me about investments. I have no idea. I don't even know. T-bills, what's that? An annuity, what's that? You know, like I don't know any of this stuff and I should. And for whatever reason, I've kept I have my bills paid, my taxes are paid and I have a little saved up and that's about it. Hmm. And I don't know how to grow that well. I have money noise.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners? Anything else you're thinking about or what's ahead for you or what you've recently realized or anything?
I want to thank you so much for this platform and I will probably listen to it and go, oh, I should have said this. I should have said that. So I'm going to try not be myself up here because I rarely give interviews, but, I want to thank you first, Jane, for the work you're doing with LA CASA. And I want to thank you for providing this platform for people like myself. So I want to first thank you for that. I would just only add that what I'm currently doing now, because that's something a lot of readers are like, what are you doing now? And so I currently am the director of outreach for Connect Our Kids. My role is primarily to reach out to potential users, let them know what Connect Our Kids is, which is we're a nonprofit that essentially brings high tech and sophisticated family search and engagement software to foster care. So if there's anyone out there in the audience who's either a CASA volunteer or you're a caseworker or your role in a nonprofit is to find families for kids in foster care, you can go to our website at connectourkids.org and start using our people search tools to start finding families. You don't have to get a training at all to start using our freely accessible tools and then sign up for our Family Connections training. So it's all free, freely accessible tools. And let's get these kids out of foster care.
So valuable. really so valuable, really. And it, you're a terrific representative, by the way, for it. I heard you speak about it very briefly at a film screening, and I immediately said, what is that? I want to know more about it. I think everybody in the audience did too. And it's a terrific tool, and I can't wait till it's sweeping the nation. I know a lot of states are using it, a lot of caseworkers are using it, but maybe not enough, right? Like it really needs to be out there for everybody.
It really does. And so you have to become aware of something before you dive into it. So first, people need to find out more about connectourkids.org. So I encourage people to check us out, connectourkids.org. And if people want to reach out to me, they can, to find out more at georgette@connectourkids.org.
And your website is georgettetodd.com.
Yeah. Yes, that is. So outside of Connect Our Kids, if you read my book or it touches you in a way, or you would like me to speak, you can reach out to me on my website at www.georgettetodd.com.
That's super. And the book is available on Amazon. And the new 10th anniversary audition will be available October 1st. The podcast will be out by then, so people can go directly to Amazon or probably other platforms as well to buy the book. So
Barnes & Noble as well. And I will have it on Apple Books as well.
Wonderful. So. Thank you so much, Georgette, for being so frank and also being such a terrific, tireless advocate for kids in care. I think it's so, so valuable. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Georgette, for taking the time to share your story with us and for everyone else who's listening. You've been through an awful lot, and it's really great that you've taken that and turned it into something that is giving back to the community. Keep writing. It really makes a difference. And if anyone out there would like to get Georgette's book, it's called Foster Girl, A Memoir, and you can pick it up at Amazon. Join us next week for America Gutierrez. When America was 10 years old, she and her siblings, including her teenage pregnant sister, were placed in foster care. When her grieving and depressed mother was no longer able to take care of them, America was never happy in her foster home. She felt unloved and bullied, but she made it out, got an education, and has made a happy home life for herself. So join us next week for America Gutierrez. Thank you for listening, and be well. If you or someone you know is harming themselves or thinking about harming themselves, go to crisistextline.org. If you see something, say something. If you suspect a child's health or safety is jeopardized in any way by parents or anyone else, contact the Child Protective Services Agency in your county. 24-hour hotlines are staffed by trained social workers who will help you through the process, and you can do so anonymously. In California, you can call the Child Protection Hotline at 800-540-4000. So if you see something, say something. You might be saving a child's life. If you want to know more about becoming a CASA anywhere in the country, go to nationalcasagal.org. And in LA, casala.org. And if you want to know more about becoming a foster parent, check out the National Foster Parent Association at nfponline.org. There's also faithfosterfamilies.org and adoptuskids.org. There's tons of other information online as well, so you can just hunt around. We also want to thank the supremely talented Christina Apostolopoulos for her beautiful original music. You can find her music on Spotify or Instagram at Christina Aposta. And also thank you to Yukon Har for his engineering. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you hear and you find it as valuable as we do, please rate us and hit subscribe. You can also make a donation at bonusbabies.org. See you next time.